Hi, this is Tish Perlman. I hope you've been enjoying all of the exciting guests we've been featuring on Out of Bounds. We certainly have had a lot of fun meeting all of these fascinating people. But in order for us to keep bringing you our independent programming, we really do need your help. And every little bit does help, believe me. It would be so great if you would consider sending a tax-deductible donation to our fiscal sponsor. It's the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. And I guarantee you, it's really easy. All you have to do is log on to earts.org/support. That's earts.org/support. Thank you so much. Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the award-winning naturalist, poet, and storyteller Diane Ackerman. Ackerman is the best-selling author of A Natural History of the Senses and The Zookeeper's Wife. She recently published a gorgeous new book called Dawn Light, Dancing with Cranes and Other Ways to Start the Day. It was published by W.W. Norton. And I welcome you to the show, Diane. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here again.
Now, the new book explores dawn through science, art, mythology, as well as through your own senses. What made you want to tie all these disciplines together in regard to the morning light?
Well, I always love to bring together many different kinds of fascinating morsels in my books, as well as religion and science and history and many different kinds of things, because I just feel the world isn't knowable from one perspective. I want to look at it from as wide a perspective as possible. And in the case of dawn, well, dawn is part of the great parentheses of our lives. It's a time of birth and rebirth and awakening, and symbolically so in many different cultures. It happens to be a time when human beings are most vulnerable, so it's as survivors that we all greet the dawn, whether we're aware of it or not. And it's a spectacular time of day when the weight of the world really hasn't settled on your shoulders yet. You haven't gone off to work, probably. All of the day's worries may not have assaulted you quite yet. It's a time of great freedom, physically, emotionally, in different kinds of ways. But having said that, I could have chosen really any other time of day. It's really a book about awakening more than anything else, I think. And it happens to be set in Ithaca for most of it, in upstate New York, and partly in Florida. But again, it could be in Bali or in Istanbul or any place else.
Yeah, because it's very personal. It's very philosophical. I think it's interesting the way you tie poetry and science together. They don't often go hand in hand, you know, the romantic poet and the fact-filled scientist. How did you meld those two?
Well, that really was a problem for me pretty early on. I don't mean with the book. I mean in my life. Because when I went to college, I discovered, as we do, that you have to choose between the arts and the sciences. Well, how silly. As I was saying, the world isn't knowable from just one perspective. I wanted to do both. And I was very fortunate to be able to go to Cornell and have on my graduate committees a poet, A.R. Ammons, and a scientist, Carl Sagan. And between the two of them, they pretty much legitimized whatever I was doing, and I could do interdisciplinary work. And so that's what I did. And in the case of this specific book, one thing leads to another. You know, I'll be outside and noticing something flickering at the edge of my awareness. I don't know exactly what it is, but I'm sure it was something. It wasn't nothing. And then I start looking around and discover the tiniest life form. And it seems to be almost translucent. And find out that it's really an ant of some sort. Well, then, of course, I want to know more. And I start going inside and learning about ghost ants and where they come from and all different sorts of things. That happens to me all the time. My curiosity is just nomadic and ravenous.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I mean, you can see the poet watching, and the scientist then kicks in to try to find out what the poet saw.
Exactly. I don't want to be a scientist, but I love the revelations of science. And, yeah, I suppose that is really what motivates me, a poet's eye more than anything, and probably a poet's heart. And I want to somehow find the interconnectedness of all living things.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier in your book about your sense of wonder that you've kept, and so many people lose that when they become adults. How have you kept that in your heart?
Gosh, first of all, I could say, well, here's exactly what you do. Here's the program. But the truth is that it's probably just a mineral, visceral part of me that has stayed with me. Most of me is still about 11.
Uh-huh.
And hasn't gotten past that. And so I get up in the morning, and I'm startled to be here. I mean, just to be here at all, surrounded by golden-shouldered parakeets and marine iguanas and prom dresses and jealousy and all of this stuff. I'm amazed from moment to moment. So there is that. But having said that, there certainly are ways to rekindle that sense of wonder. And really, all it requires is paying attention. And that's most of what I do, just pay attention. We live in a very distracting and distractible time, and growing increasingly so by the moment. But if we are just mindful, as the Buddhists say, if we just pause a moment and pay attention to something that we are seeing or hearing or touching or smelling, and consider it non-judgmentally in the present moment, not attached to any mind theaters or memories or anything like that, but just what it is right now, the world suddenly becomes a much more comforting place, a much more fascinating place. And I find that priorities start lining themselves up with an almost audible clicking. You know, what's really important in the world starts to become apparent when you pull things away from all of their entanglements and just start looking at them without judging them.
Yeah, or without trying to interpret them or evaluate them.
Exactly, all of that. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it's a kind of mindfulness. And a lot of artists have practiced it. That's why Monet figures so largely in Dawn Light, because he was so much a man of the dawn, who rose at 5 every day. And
I love your meditations about Monet. To talk to us a little bit more about that, the way he captured the light, and he obviously has captured so many of our imaginations.
He really was fascinated by what he described as the instantaneous, and he said that he had to work very hard to produce the instantaneous, as artists do. But he would set up a dozen, 20 canvases, maybe most famously across from a cathedral in France, and on each one just try to capture the fleeting, delicate tracery of light in that instant as it passed over the face of the cathedral and poured into the different nooks and crevices. And he looked at it as if he was watching melting wax pour into the different places. And he just loved capturing the atmospherics of being, what it is like to be alive on the planet, what it is like to watch the light on the cathedral. Mm-hmm. Now, just as I was describing that to you, I was getting chills because I was thinking of Monet, and in my mind's eye, I could see him in front of the cathedral doing that. And it seems like such a thrilling enterprise for him to be involved in. And yet, he did that all the time. He was fascinated by the moment and the fact that every minute contains, well, more than 60 millions of fleeting moments that we sometimes catch a glimpse of and record and share.
You have a quote from Monet about his water landscapes. He said, "They reveal the instability of the universe transforming itself every moment before our eyes." And that seems to me what you're trying to do with your book.
Thank you. I hope so, because that is how we experience life. Mm-hmm. We slur over all of that, because if we didn't, we wouldn't be able to deal with the UPS man or get our work done or anything. So we become very masterful. And certainly mastery is one of our great and most becoming traits, but at a cost.
Mm.
The cost is that we lose innocence. We lose that instability, that Monet was talking about. We lose the innocence of when things are absolutely new and we don't quite know what it is from where or when. And so we are paying attention to everything very, very carefully. And we are at our most alive. That's why people who are in danger report that they felt so alive. Sure, they did.
Yeah, yeah.
All of their senses were tuned up and ready to go to keep them alive. But then the more masterful we become, the brain says, oh, yeah, I'm wing walking again. Big deal. I remember that, you know. And it doesn't have to pay attention to as many details. This is also true, I think, of people and relationships. The better we get to know someone, unfortunately, the less we need to really pay attention to them because we've gotten to know their habits and ways of being. And we say we take them for granted. And what we really mean is that we're not paying attention to them as much as we did when we first knew them. Mm-hmm. So there is mastery and there is innocence, and we do need to slur over these details. But when we do, we find that we sometimes are in a state of what we call boredom. Because things aren't new to us.
So we need to try to capture that early morning sunrise
in
all the aspects of our lives.
In all the aspects of our lives. Now, for me, it was especially important because, although, you know, as we were saying, Dawn Light is about all different kinds of things, including beekeeping, I think it's mainly about the healing power of nature in troubled times and times of uncertainty. It was being written as my partner of many years was lying in the hospital across the lake with pneumonia. Mm. And his fever was spiking. I didn't know if or when he was going to recover. And my world just felt calamitously out of balance. And there was nothing, it seemed, that I could do but just wait and wither. Mm. And so I would return home at night, grab a few hours of sleep, and then in the morning, I found it very replenishing to go out and take a walk about, stroll through the garden or around the neighborhood, and see what the rest of nature was up to, lose myself in nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because when we do that, it's a kind of transcendence. It's why people have turned to nature since time immemorial to lose themselves like that. And it's very replenishing. You find yourself also.
Yeah, it helps one to meditate, to be in those early morning quiet hours. It's almost like you can even hear your own voice whispering.
You can. And there's something special about being up before the world wakes up, don't you think?
Oh, I absolutely am one who does that. So
our corner of the world,
I know what you
anyway.
Mean.
But it doesn't matter what time of day you actually do it. My partner doesn't see dawn ever. He stays up until about 4 in the morning, and very often we greet each other as I'm waking up and he's going to sleep, and his circadian rhythms are just back to front like that. But he has other periods of awakening, and one can.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the subtitle of your book is about cranes, dancing with cranes and other ways to start the day. Talk to us about cranes. They're endangered and they're magical.
They are endangered and they are magical in many cultures. In Asian cultures, they are thought to carry souls on their way to heaven. How beautiful.
That is.
In Mexico, they feel that monarch butterflies carry children's souls to heaven. Also lovely. But cranes decorate the lives of many cultures. And we have whooping cranes that are just perilously endangered in our country. And they migrate now, thanks to the generosity of spirit of two men who some years ago decided they would see if they could teach baby cranes how to migrate by getting them to imprint on their ultralights and then leading them down to Florida. You know, see one, do one, teach one is pretty much the way it works in the bird world.
That's amazing.
Yes. And so they dressed up in crane suits and they put crane puppets on their hands, because if the cranes started to get attached to human beings, it would be very dangerous for them. Mm-hmm. And in any case, they needed to learn to be cranes. So they just showed them what looked sort of like a mother crane and would feed them kind of like a mother crane would. And they took them out into the swamps and taught them how to dance and wade and do crane stuff. And then they drove their little ultralight around the nesting area, playing sounds of mother cranes. And they would feed them from the ultralight and soon get them to be very familiar with it. And in time, sure enough, they learned to take off and they would form a wedge behind the ultralight parent crane and learn to fly to Florida to their overwintering grounds because they really can't survive in the north.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the few cranes, I think at one point it was down to 15, only needed to be shown one time. They could record it in their minds, and they could find their way back safely.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Diane Ackerman. We're talking about her new book, Dawn Light. Now, I wanted before we run out of time, you discussed the fact that much has been lost because kids no longer play in nature. Talk to us about that. It really is an endangered notion to let children learn about themselves via nature.
I think that's true. When I was little, gosh, we used to beg to go outside and play. That was the big thing.
Yeah, we did too. We did.
Yes, can I go outside and play? Well, now so much play happens indoors, and it happens in front of computer screens, and we use a different kind of awareness, a different kind of paying attention when we are looking at a screen. There have been a lot of studies done about this. And furthermore, we didn't evolve to do that. I mean, our bodies are still Pleistocene, no matter how advanced mm-hmm. our culture is.
Mm-hmm.
And we evolved to feel part of the changing seasons and of nature. And I think that there's a terrible hollowness and loneliness at the heart of society that forms very early on in children when they are exiled from nature, which since the beginning has been their real home mm-hmm. and their real parent, not to mention a wonderful laboratory of exploration.
Oh, absolutely.
And the best place to teach yourself about everything.
Uh-huh. And to think.
And you know, to think.
You're out there by yourself. And you're
to make your own bird, rhythms.
Feel the wind. And it's something that haunts you through your life or stays with you, some of that.
I think that's true. It offers a kind of freedom where you can make your own pace
mm-hmm.
And you can chop things up into your own attention blinks,
mm-hmm.
you know, not what somebody else has devised for you.
Yeah.
It's very different. You can personalize it.
Yeah. It's where one learns to be oneself, I think. You say in the book that children lose their sense of their own wilderness, which I thought was gorgeous.
Thank you. Yes, I think that's true. You know, even if you divorce a dog or a cat from nature, it becomes disconsolate. And there's no wilderness consulate you can go to and apply, you know, for help. What we do instead is that we tend to take nature homeopathically.
Mm.
We go to the park. We,
the little tiny doses
exactly.
that we think are going to heal us. Mm.
Yes, but I think we need it more regularly, and it doesn't have to be some kind of formal thing. You can really just go outside and just take a little stroll around and see what's happening outside of yourself,
mm-hmm.
outside of your brain, outside of your family, in the wider family of nature.
Yeah, my memories as a kid, too, I mean, and they're still with me as an adult, of walking the beach and getting up on the roof and watching the sunset. You know, I'm from Southern California.
And you were able to do that
there.
That's
still part of my whole character.
Absolutely.
That child who was able to do that.
Absolutely. And for me, too, I grew up in rural Illinois. It made a huge difference. Now we have to sometimes create our own wilderness, our own rural, whatever state you like. But we can do that very easily. And there have been tons of studies done with juvenile delinquents, for instance, that have shown that they can improve their ways and just be happier with themselves if they are taken out into nature regularly,
mm-hmm.
if they have playgrounds outside.
Yeah, because it's a familiar place, even if we don't recognize it. It's
That's
familiar
right.
to our pores
Absolutely.
And to our cells. And,
That's right.
Yeah. Now you talk about how you love winter, and you wrote, "I love that snow is a mineral falling as billions of temporary stars." So tell us about your love of winter.
I do love winter. I like how crystalline snow is. I like how many colors snow has. I love to play in snow. And I think I'm getting into my 11-year-old voice at the moment. Just became aware of it. Because one of my funnest things, which I do all the time, and heaven knows what the neighbors think, is that I love to shake hands with tall evergreen trees that are covered in snow. And what I do is I go down the street and I shake hands with them, you know, really vigorously. And then the snow falls off of all of the top limbs and it cascades over your head. And it's just wonderful.
So when people see Diane Ackerman shaking hands with trees, it's deliberate.
It's deliberate. I like to make snow angels. I'm not going to go into detail about this, but it's really nice to make snow angels naked. And yes.
Oh, I bet that feels very interesting.
It does. It does. And I just love playing in snow. I like to cross-country ski. I like that snow takes so many different forms and that it forms crystalline stars. And I write about people who photograph snow and study snow because it's one of the most extraordinary things on our planet, just as rain is. We don't look at these things very carefully, but there's an example of where I was watching it and playing it and enjoying it and thought, wonder what it really looks like. And discovered, when I looked into it a little, that rain isn't round, that the raindrops aren't round, that they change shapes hundreds and hundreds of times per second as they bang into each other.
Wow.
And so do snow flakes as they fall. And that reminded me very much of being human and what a personality is like and how we see people walking towards us across the street. And they look whole, but the truth is that they really are a collection of many different selves and personalities holding themselves in equilibrium and that we identify as one person in that moment.
Oh, that's an interesting observation. Now, you say that dawn is the best time to spot meteors, but a dangerous time when people often die because of quick rise in blood pressure as we are roused from sleep.
That's true. It's a very dangerous time. Most strokes and heart attacks happen at dawn. This is not just true for us. It's also true for hummingbirds and lots of other creatures who go into a kind of suspended animation at night because they need to quiet their body down. They've been so active during the day. But then you have to jumpstart your body again, and blood pressure has to soar. You need to wake up. There are other reasons why dawn is dangerous. Duels, for example, are fought at dawn, and that is mainly so that people will miss. You know, the antagonist, it's assumed, will have been up all night, really nervous. Then they're given pistols. They walk away from each other, and they swivel around fast, and it's hoped that in the very dim light of dawn, they'll miss.
Is that so?
Yeah, that's why they started doing that. They didn't really want to kill each other. This was a point of honor.
It's too bad Aaron Burr didn't know about
that. It's really a shame. You know, choose high noon instead.
And do you often stay? I know you live in Florida and in Ithaca. Do you see meteors? I mean, have you actually seen a lot of meteors in both places?
I have, and it's fun to see them. There's no doubt. It's kind of like bugs hitting the windscreen of a car, I think I say there, the way the meteors hit Earth and streak across the sky and make that wonderful little, like, sigh across the darkness. Beautiful to watch that. We don't always get to see a lot, since we have kind of cloud cover a lot in Ithaca. But it's great to lie out and watch them.
Did you, I know you're somebody who gets up in the morning, and obviously this book started with you probably getting up at dawn and noticing things around you and tying in all these aspects. Did this change you in any way when you deliberately decided to start writing about it and putting it into concrete words?
You know, every book changes me. I'm not just saying that in some flippant way. Every book truly changes me, and I'm sure that that's why I decide to write the book without knowing it exactly. I sense that there are profound things that will change in me as a result. And that was certainly true with Dawn Light. It meant that I spent quite a long time thinking about awakening and what it really means and how we heal an aching spirit, how we live in times of uncertainty, where we go for consolation and soothing. These are places I always went, but I never really organized my thoughts about it before. And I learned lots of individual things that changed me. I had no idea that Monet was inspired by the Japanese printmakers and what their life stories were like, or about the 10th century woman of court, Sai Shonagon. I had read the Pillow Book, but I didn't know the intimacies of her life. And I've just learned and been inspired by a lot of the people that I learned about while I was pursuing the book.
You know, this does seem like a very personal book, more so than some of your other ones. You mentioned your own physical pain. You mentioned that sometimes dawns remind you of your deceased mother.
Yes.
Did you deliberately try to make this more personal, or did it just happen because of the subject?
It's probably a combination, that I'm probably at an age where I'm not so reluctant to let people see parts of myself that maybe I was a little timid about revealing earlier on, because we all are in different ways. You know, we compare our insides to other people's outsides, and that's a dangerous thing to do. You can't win in that comparison. But then you get to a certain age and you think, oh, that's what we're doing. Everybody is like this. And we all mourn and we all suffer, and there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, it's so much connected to our humanity that it's probably something that would be good to think about and talk about. So partly I decided to do it on purpose. Partly it's just the sort of book that lends itself to that, because it's a book very much about mindfulness. And paying attention to something, even pain, helps with it. And there are mindfulness-based stress reduction clinics that have cropped up, sometimes because they're run by people with a Buddhist background, that specialize in exactly this. You know, don't try to get rid of the pain and suffering that you're in. That's just going to make it worse.
Yeah.
Instead, why don't you think about the nature of it more and how you cope with it in your life and how it fits in and stuff like that?
Yeah. Because you mentioned in your book that you've been in pain a certain morning, but you're not unhappy.
No, it's all part of the adventure. You know, that was something that Amelia Earhart said once. I don't know if I included that in the book, but she crashed one of her planes. And unfortunately, because she was Amelia Earhart, there were many news people. So she got out of her plane and they asked her about this. And she just looked at them and said, no, it's all part of the adventure.
Yeah.
And that's what life is for me. It's all part of the adventure. It doesn't just include joy. It includes many of the dark emotions, too, and lots of pain and suffering, but it's no less beautiful for that.
Yeah. Is this, when I finished the book, I was thinking that it was a gift to the eventual fading of the light in some ways. You know, and in not a sad way, but just you've left behind a beautiful book of poetry, which is a tribute to that.
Thank
you. We will all leave.
Thank you. It is very much, I think, a book about being able to enjoy life and praise life without denying death and suffering, but being able to accommodate that. You don't have to like it, but being able to accommodate it in the greater enterprise of being alive.
Right. Well, Diane Eckerman, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Go out and buy Dawn Light, Dancing with Cranes, and Other Ways to Start the Day. It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.